This is Kirti reporting for CHRY and for Radio Basics, the radio wing of Basics Community News Service. I'm here with Radio Basics co-host Steve Da Silva. Hi, Steve.
How's it going, Kirti?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Well, it is Friday, December 10th, and on the show with us tonight is Edward Herman. He is Professor Emeritus of Finance at Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. Many may recognize his name from one of his most famous titles, Manufacturing Consent, co-authored with Noam Chomsky in 1988. Edward Herman has published many articles and books analyzing the relationship between the media and war and imperialism. And tonight we will be talking about his most recent title, The Politics of Genocide, co-authored with David Peterson, not to be confused with Ontario's former premier. Edward, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
Edward, the overarching thesis of The Politics of Genocide and also an essay that I read recently, Genocide Inflation is the Real Human Rights Threat, is that Western powers or Western imperialism shapes how we understand genocides and mass killings to suit their own interests. So in many cases, you know, veritable genocides in which the West is complicit are denied, masked, or completely absent from official or mainstream discourses, while in other cases the scale of violence in certain conflicts or mass killings is inflated, while the origins of those conflicts are distorted, a phenomenon you refer to as genocide inflation. Can you elaborate upon these phenomena, genocide denial and genocide inflation? Why are certain atrocities and mass killings worthy of our attention while others are not?
Well, this is a question of the interests of the powers that be. The U.S. government is involved in genocides. It commits them. It supports them. Committed genocide in Vietnam. It supported a genocide in Indonesia. But it certainly doesn't want it called that. So there's a denial. It denies it. And people who support the U.S. government will also play it down, essentially deny it. I take Samantha Power, who's a noted writer on genocide. If you read her book, which won lots of prizes, you'll find that she doesn't talk about Vietnam at all. Mm-hmm. And she hardly mentions Indonesia. She focuses on Bosnia and Yugoslavia, which have been U.S. targets. So the whole process is really a political process. The genocides that we engage in or support, or mass killings that we engage in or support, if one doesn't want to use that loaded word genocide, these are sort of effectively denied. The denied in this case may all just simply mean that the word isn't applied to them and they're not talked about much. Whereas when we get to cases where we're targeting somebody who's doing some killing, there's a tendency to inflate those numbers. And the most beautiful case in modern times is the Yugoslav wars, where in Bosnia, it was alleged there was genocide, the Srebrenica genocide, and Kosovo was alleged to be genocide. But the numbers involved in those cases are really remarkably small compared to something like Vietnam or Indonesia or Iraq. Mm-hmm. One of our favorite comparisons is between Iraq and, say, Bosnia and Kosovo. Mm-hmm. In Iraq, we employed sanctions through the UN against Iraq from about 1990 through 2003. Mm-hmm. And there was an article in Foreign Affairs, which is an establishment a journal. Mm-hmm. There was an article by two rather conservative fellows called "Sanctions of Mass Destruction," and they argued that the sanctions policy against Iraq imposed by the United States and Britain through the UN involved more deaths than all the weapons of mass destruction in history. Wow. So here we're talking about really big numbers. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there was this episode where Madeleine Albright television, was asked about all these sanctions deaths in Iraq, and was it worth it? 500,000 dead children. And Madeleine Albright said, yes, it was worth it.
That's right.
So here you've got mass killing, really mass killing. And this is, of course, not only not called genocide, it was really, that was never picked up and discussed. Mm-hmm. And then the United States invades Iraq, another million down the tube. So we're talking about several million people. Whereas in Bosnia, the inflated total for quite a while, for some years, from 1992 into 2003, it was estimated, alleged, that there were 250,000 Muslims killed by the Serbs. Then there were studies made by establishment sources, the tribunal itself and the Norwegian government-funded studies, which brought this number down to 100,000, of which about 65,000 were civilians. So here you have, in Bosnia, say 65,000 civilians killed. This is alleged to be a genocide that was worth enormous attention, and Samantha Power spends a lot of time on that. So, and here, 500,000 children in the sanctions of mass destruction, it's not worth mentioning. There's real genocide denial, and there's real genocide inflation.
Mm-hmm. What is to delve a little bit deeper into the politics of the actual of the word genocide. Certainly, the West's and the media's labeling what happened, the civil war that was unfolding in Yugoslavia and different regions, as genocide or genocidal was certainly not politically neutral or innocent, right? There was interest behind that.
Certainly. You know, we were going after the Serbs, and in fact, the tribunal was set up to go after the Serbs, but in 1993, it was pretty clear. In fact, there's a wonderful book by a Canadian author, Michael Mandel, called How America Gets Away with Murder, in which he has very good details on the extent to which the tribunal was created to help NATO fight a war against Serbia. And its function was to go after Serbs. And any peace moves that came along, they could not be carried out because we had to have justice first. We couldn't have peace. So we actually would not allow the Lisbon Treaty in 92 to be implemented.
That's right.
And we postponed these things. So the politics of this is really pretty gross.
Mm-hmm. Almost 40 years ago, yourself and Noam Chomsky wrote a book called Counter-Revolutionary Violence, in which you lay out a framework for understanding atrocities around the world. And from this presentation of the mainstream media, there are four types of ways of presenting mass killings: constructive, nefarious, benign, and mythical. Do these categories still hold for today's presentation on genocides?
Yeah, in fact, we use it in this book, The Politics of Genocide. The constructive ones, constructive genocides, are ones that we do. So under that rubric, we talk about the sanctions of mass destruction in Iraq and the invasion occupation of Iraq. And go back farther, Vietnam, Indonesia, these were constructive meaning that we do it. So therefore, they're constructive by definition, whereas the nefarious, I mean, obviously an ironically used word, nefarious are those that the enemy uses. So the Bosnian case, the Serbs in Kosovo, these would be nefarious genocides. And of course, as I just pointed out, these are inflated. And then benign means in genocides that are carried out by our friends or clients. So we don't pay much attention to them. They're hardly called genocide. Little attention is given to them. This would actually include something like whatever Israel, the Gaza attack, or the destruction of the Tamils in Sri Lanka, that would be benign too. These are mm-hmm. these were we were friendly toward the Sri Lankan government, mm-hmm. and the mythical well, this is a genocide carried out by an enemy that doesn't even exist. And in our book, we talk about the Rakach massacre in Kosovo, where allegedly 40 to 45 Kosovo Albanians were killed. But I think we demonstrate effectively that, this wasn't true. That it's true that there were people killed, but they were killed in a fight, and then they were put on display for the benefit of an American observer. Mm-hmm. And our friend Louise Arbour rushed to the scene to declare that this was a mass killing by the Serbs,
yes.
But it wasn't true. So this is the category mythical. Mm-hmm. So these categories hold very well.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you bring up Louise Arbour, a Canadian, a woman who went on to become a Supreme Court judge here in Canada later after her roles in Yugoslavia and Rwanda. I want to come back to her because her role looms very large in the so-called Rwandan genocide, which I'd like to speak about in a little bit more detail, because I know there may be people out there who have this notion that, yes, but, you know, what if there is that case of a genocide unfolding, and what are we to do? Just stand by and watch? You know, are we to just to be casual bystanders and not intervene and not do anything? So I think it's we should delve into at least one or two cases in greater detail. So let's take the Rwandan genocide, or at least how it's understood, how it's been constructed in the West by the media, by the Hotel Rwandas, by Hollywood, and so on and so forth. You know, a major part of the mythology is that the West stood by, did nothing, and since then it's been proclaimed never again, this mea culpa attitude, which is the foundation for this responsibility to protect idea.
This is an amazing case, Steve, because as a matter of fact, I really believe that there was a genocide there, but it's misallocated. And then it was dead. It has an associated genocide. The same party that carried out the genocide in Rwanda was carried out an even larger genocide in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
That's right.
But of course, in my judgment, in my opinion, and from my research, the genocide was in the hands of Paul Kagame and his. RPF. So if you trace it back to the origins of this genocide, mm-hmm. Paul Kagame was really he was a member of the Ugandan army,
mm-hmm.
And he actually trained in Fort Leavenworth for a while.
Yeah.
And he and his forces, some members of the Ugandan army, invaded Rwanda back in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a tremendous amount of destruction. That happened about the same time as Iraq invaded Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
But the Security Council, in the next day, ordered Saddam Hussein to get out of the Security Council did nothing following this invasion of Rwanda. And in fact, the United States then began to press the Hutu government of Rwanda to allow Kagame's forces and Kagame's political allies to assume more power in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually penetrated into his army and into the public services, into mm-hmm. the government. But I think there's very good evidence that he was planning to take over Rwanda. There was an accord, the so-called Arusha Accords in mm-hmm. 1993, in which it was agreed that there would be an election in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
But it was absolutely certain that Kagame would lose that election because his Tutsis were only about 15% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And he himself was not very popular because hundreds of thousands of Hutus had been driven off the land in his invasions from Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
and he would have been crushed in a free election. So it's I think highly significant that a genocide took place. I think there's very good evidence that it was all planned by Kagame. He needed to fight a war to assume power because he never could have won it in a free election. So then on April 6, 1994, the plane of the president of Rwanda is shot down at the Kigali airport. And that, everybody agrees, is the triggering event to the genocide.
Yeah.
And then a mass killing took place. And within 100 days, Kagame had taken over Rwanda.
Yeah,
it's a crucial question as to who shot the plane down.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very interesting that if you look at the Hollywood representations of the Rwandan genocide, if you just kind of try to reason through it, you know, one must be left with the question: how is it that a people facing genocide end up in power at the end of it?
That's what we feature in our book. What an amazing coincidence that the people who actually are supposedly the victims of genocide win power in 100 days. It means the guy, Kagame, and his forces who took over power, their own people were the ones that were killed on a larger scale. It's completely implausible, and it's a big lie, which I think we demonstrate in our book. Mm-hmm. But getting to the shooting down of the plane, there was a tribunal established to go after the villains in this genocide. And at that time, Louise Arbour was the head of this tribunal. And a group was appointed to study this shootdown. The group reported back, a man, Michael Horrigan, was in charge of this investigation, an Australian lawyer. He reported back to Louise Arbour that Kagame had been responsible for shooting down the plane. Louise Arbour then canceled the investigation. And in the subsequent 13 years, no further investigation has been made by the tribunal, which is an amazing thing. I mean, if this was the triggering event, tribunal would be extremely interested in who triggered the event.
Yes.
So what this proves, I think it proves pretty definitively that Kagame did the shooting down,
and
that the tribunal was an agent of the United States and the NATO powers. They liked Kagame, and therefore nothing would be done about the triggering event, and it still hasn't been done up to today. Then this tribunal has never found anybody except a Hutu guilty of any crime in Rwanda. So we get to this question of whether the world, the West, stood by while these events took place. This is a gigantic lie.
Yeah.
The West didn't just stand by. It actually, the United States actually it caused the UN to withdraw some troops. The Hutu government was calling for more UN troops. And here a genocide was about to take place. And the genocidists, the Hutus, were calling for more UN troops. And the United States didn't want it. But the Kagame didn't want it because he was about to take over the country by force. And the United States was supporting him. So all this business of an apology for standing by is a gigantic lie. Mm. The West was part of the genocidal operation.
Mm-hmm.
The Kagame was their man.
Yeah, a lie which supports future colonial interventions by creating this mythology that they were never there. They had nothing to do with it in the first place.
Yes.
It's highly significant that the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda had that mandate to investigate crimes only between April 6th and July 1st, that only crimes committed, international crimes, war crimes committed between that period could be investigated. But nonetheless, when Michael Horrigan had found that Kagame and even the UN may have been complicit in the shooting down of the plane, it was all shut down, which makes Louise Arbour in fact, party to war crimes.
You know, I don't think it's true that that was the tribunal's time limit. I think the tribunal's time limit was for that whole year, from January 1. So I think, the shootdown was within that time limit. Yeah. I absolutely know that. So the calling off of the investigation was a horrible political act of apologetics for Kagame and the mass killing that followed. So anyway, this gets back. My point is, is that there was mass killing that followed, but it was dominantly by Kagame. In fact, one thing we cite in our book is an internal memo to the United States Secretary of State, an internal memo that reported that Kagame's forces were killing 10,000 civilians a month in April 1994. Mm-hmm. 10,000 civilians a month. The mass killing alleged at Srebrenica was 8,000. I don't think it's, I think that's a great inflation. But here's Kagame killing 10,000 civilians a month in a State Department internal memo. Mm-hmm. And what did the United States do about it? Did nothing. And the press never picked it up. It was Peter Erlinder who found this document. And of course, it hasn't been publicized at all. But I'm saying that there was genocide in Rwanda, but it wasn't caused by the Hutus. It was caused by Kagame and his forces, which was their only means of taking over the state, following their shooting down of that plane, and with U.S. and other support. So you've got the reversal of the genocidists. But then also, as I said, Kagame in subsequent years, along with Museveni in Uganda, invaded the Congo.
That's right.
And the UN reports we cite from 2002 indicate that the excess deaths in the area that Kagame occupied in the Congo were 3.5 million. It's 3.5 million excess deaths. Mm-hmm. That was as early as 2002. And then you had the further reports more recently about Kagame's and Muskia killings in the Congo. So we're dealing here with a genocidist of the absolutely first order. Idi Amin allegedly killed between 100 and 300,000 people. Here's Kagame, responsible maybe for 3.5 million in the Congo just through 2002, plus hundreds of thousands in Rwanda.
Yeah.
And he's a hero in the West.
And he's a hero,
Yes, in Canada. He's celebrated in Canada.
That's
got some real real apologists for this genocidist in Canada. Canada's the hotbed of genocidal inflation.
And
genocidal denial simultaneously.
Yeah, exactly. We also have the genocide of indigenous peoples, which continues to this day. So Canada, and indeed, it was a leading intellectual, not to go off too much on a tangent, but a leading intellectual and a promoter of these concepts you're talking about as embodied in the responsibility to protect doctrine, Michael Ignatieff, who wasn't an American academic for a long time, but a Canadian, and also now the leader of the Liberal Party, he played a very central role to basically developing and propping up this concept of responsibility to protect.
Yeah, he's a remarkable man. I've been following his career. I had a nice article on him in Z Magazine, but it focused on his incredible article in 2005 in the New York Times. I think it was called "Who Are Americans to Think That They Can Export Freedom Everywhere?" And the man actually proposes that the United States is in the business of promoting democracy everywhere. And the reason he believes that, he admits that we've been supported dictators and on a large scale in the past, but we've changed course. And how does he know it? Because George W. Bush said so. I mean, that's about not it. If you read this article in the New York Times Magazine, this amazing man seems to believe that if the president of the United States, we call him the waterboarding president, if he says we're supporting freedom everywhere, then that's it.
I believe it's what he called Empire Light. This is Michael Ignatieff's term.
Yeah, that's a nice phrase, too.
So, Edward, let's talk a little bit about international law and the politics of genocide and how has the politics of genocide influenced international legal processes. I have in mind particularly the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia and the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and the responsibility to protect doctrine. Do other victims of genocide or Western-backed atrocities, such as native people, Iraqis, Palestinians, Afghanis, or Congolese, have recourse to these institutions?
Well, they certainly do not. These are instruments of the powerful, and these tribunals. If you look at these tribunals, every tribunal is established by the United States and its allies to serve its own purposes. And as I mentioned, this wonderful book by Mandel, How America Gets Away with Murder, describes in detail how the Yugoslav Tribunal was established following the U.S. Secretary of State's announcement that the Serbs needed to be brought to book. This was back in 1992-93. The Secretary of State says this, and within a few months you've got a tribunal established by the Security Council, and it goes after Serbs in accord with there's no way the Serbs the Iraqis or the Palestinians could get a tribunal. And they can't even get one of my favorite comparisons here is during the Kosovo crisis and struggle there, the United States insisted that the Serbs allow monitors into Kosovo, and the Serbs had to agree. I mean, the United States insisted, and 1,000 or more monitors came in. But then it was proposed that there be monitors imposed on Israel on the West Bank. Mm-hmm. The West Bank actually was occupied territory, whereas Kosovo was part of Serbia. The United States said no. So there never were any monitors in Israel on the West Bank. I think this is a perfect illustration. The United States says no to monitors, and of course, you would never have an international tribunal dealing with Israel and the Gaza war.
That's right.
So the double standard is complete, and it's essentially you will have a tribunal if the United States says so. The United States doesn't even like the International Criminal Court, the Criminal Commission, the ICC. International Crime Commission. It refuses to have anything to do with it. And the reason is because that the laws underlying it do not make the Security Council powerful. They don't give the Security Council a veto right over what the ICC does. So the United States will not do it. In the case of the Yugoslav Tribunal and the Rwanda Tribunal, the Security Council is ultimately in charge, and therefore there are creations of the Security Council.
Yeah.
And the United States can veto anything. It controls things. But the ICC is slightly imperfectly controlled, therefore the U.S. won't join.
Yeah.
But the ICC is still so deferential to the United States that they won't do anything the United States doesn't like.
Yeah. So I'm glad you...
Do you realize, the point we make in the book that is absolutely spectacular, is the ICC has indicted 14 people. They're all black Africans, every one of them.
Mm. Yeah.
Not one person in the white person or northern person. And in the Africa, too, Kagame and Museveni are not included in that 14.
Yeah.
They're our clients. So it works out absolutely perfectly. Even the ICC, where the United States is not even a member, it follows exactly the rules that the United States wishes to impose.
Yeah, and it reinforces the ideology that this colonial mentality that, you know, the others, they're in need of our tutelage and our protection and so on and so forth. I'm glad you point out how unilateral international justice and international law is, the ICTR and ICT, former Yugoslavia, being instruments created by the Security Council and at the complete control of the United States. And never will those processes under the current order be directed back towards the United States. You know, for example, take the responsibility to protect doctrine, and its logic of invasion and occupation really only moves in one direction, right? According to the RTP, should, for example, like would there be an intervention? Was there an intervention in the United States when the United States government was not willing to protect and to help those people who were at the mercy of Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath, which is even more killer? There were people, aid willing to be sent by Cuba, doctors willing to come in, and the United States, rather than receiving that, was killing civilians, the National Guard, the U.S. military forces. So the logic only goes in one direction.
Oh, absolutely true. It certainly only goes in... This is a power system in the world. Power, justice is a function of the choice of the powerful. And, of course, the United States, it can actually not only who can protect Cuba against the U.S. with sponsoring this Cuban refugee network, which has been sitting in Florida and attacking Cuba for decades? I mean, you could argue that Cuba has a right to retaliate. They should bomb Washington, D.C. in retaliation for all these hundreds of attacks by terrorists who are protected by Washington.
And I should add, we're here in Canada broadcasting, and Montreal has been a headquarters as well for Cuban terrorist attacks committed against Cubans and the Cuban government by these emigre terrorists.
Yeah, it's amazing how people will swallow this. I mean, it's just internalized that there's a double standard in the world. There's one that applies to the weaker peoples, and then there's one that applies to the United States, and it's a lie. It's quite spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Given the politics of genocide as it's shaped by the force of imperialism, could you comment on the dangers that the right to protect doctrine poses to people genuinely facing massacres and genocide by imperialism and the agents of imperialism? For instance, I have in mind the Tamil civilians who were massacred in 2009 by the Sri Lankan army, who waged a merciless onslaught against the Liberation Tigers of Tamililam, LTTE, who held areas in Sri Lanka. And many Tamils were taking up right to protect, to appeal for help in the international community. Yet we saw that the West went on providing diplomatic cover of support to Sri Lanka throughout the onslaught while hunting down and labeling Tiger supporters as terrorists.
Well, depending on the RTP is a very last resort thing. Anybody, this is a desperation thing. It's like the Palestinians depending on the United States as the honest broker to deal with Israel.
Yeah.
It is so pathetic to see this Palestinian leadership acting as if the United States is an honest broker and will protect them and bargain with Israel. Here's Congress. Pledging allegiance to Israel, the whole thing is mind-boggling. So it's pathetic to see the Palestinians genuflecting. It's partly economic. The United States does give them some money, but the RTP. I think RPT is kind of a sick joke. I mean, there is no RTP in the world. There's no humanitarian intervention in the world. There's power, and there's intervention based on power. But the poor Tamils suffered from the fact not only that the RTP does not really exist, and the United States is friendly toward, but actually they suffered from the fact that the Chinese are very friendly to the Sri Lankan government.
And so even
the Iranians and the Indian government supported Sri Lanka, and would not, and to, even Cuba. Cuba was pretty friendly with the Sri Lankans and didn't support the Tamil. So the Tamils really were on their own. And in fact, most indigenous groups, most peoples who are under attack in the world are on their own. And they have to be fighting their own resistance. And it's a sad scene, but international justice does not work.
Edward, I'm just wondering if you can comment, maybe elaborate a little bit more on how this kind of logic that works behind the responsibility to protect doctrine. You know, we are in the era of the war on terror, an era of perpetual war against any people that could be conducted by the United States and its allies to preemptively strike anyone, you know, and now North Korea and Iran, the menacing of preemptive strikes against them is what is preponderant today. And but yet, in all the conflicts that are going on through the world, with the imperialist occupations and aggressions against Iraq and Afghanistan, Somalia, even when the war on terror logic is predominant, it seems like you still have that responsibility to protect logic as a secondary, even if unmentioned, even if a silent logic, it's still there. You know, I know in Canada, you know, a big part of the logic of invading Afghanistan was not just to hunt down the Taliban, you know, that pacified the conservatives, but then you also had saving women from the Taliban. That was the kind of RTP logic in there as well. And it seems like these logics are always playing out everywhere in all conflicts.
Well, I just think it's a cover. I don't think something you can't take seriously. The idea that the West was going into Afghanistan to protect women, actually, it's pretty well known. Maybe it's not generally known, but it's a fact that the United States was willing to do business with the Taliban if they were more agreeable on oil rights or oil transit rights. So, and in fact, we helped bring in the Taliban. And the government that we overthrew in Afghanistan was a relatively secular government that actually was doing more for women than anything before. And the United States actually supported Islamic fundamentalism and groups like the Taliban that were very hostile to women and hostile to secularism. So we would be coming in there to help women. I mean, it's a kind of sick joke. We always look for a rationalization for what we do. And I'm sure you're aware that the United States actually was very supportive of Saddam Hussein in the early 80s when he was fighting against Iran. We gave him weapons of mass destruction. We played dumb when he used chemical weapons against his Kurds. So he only became another Hitler at a certain exact point in time, and then he became a bad man. But so the opportunism of the powerful is overwhelming. And the responsibility to protect is used with such selectivity that I don't take it seriously any more than humanitarian intervention. Remember that your friend Michael Ignatieff was one of the great spokesmen for humanitarian intervention, which proves it's total hypocrisy.
Yeah, just to pick up on something you said there as well, like if it's incredible that only 2 years before 9/11, right, that the West was so disposed to working towards an Islamic fascist like Izetbegovic in Bosnia-Herzegovina, whom I understand had ties to many of the Islamic, you know, right-wing forces in the world today that the U.S. is claiming to attack, to be the target of the war on terror.
That's a beautiful illustration of in fact, all the liberal journalists latched on to Izetbegovic as a great Democrat, but he wrote this book called Islamic Declaration, which was republished in 1990, and which states very explicitly that his Islam is not consistent with the rights of all other groups in society besides the Islamists. And he was a great admirer of Khomeini, a great admirer of Saudi Arabia. But when he talked to the Western journalists, he always said he's a great believer in democracy, and they swallowed it, and the West swallowed it in general. But it was a complete hypocrisy. There was a relatively fairly tolerant multi-ethnic society before the wars in Bosnia. But we fought a war basically supporting an Islamic society there. There's several books that have already been written showing that Al-Qaeda made its first big inroads into Europe through Bosnia, through at the time of Begovic's tenure. So there are lots of paradoxes here, but the paradoxes dissolve when you understand that power is looking for a way to do its thing immediately, and it thinks it pretty short run.
Yeah, which is why they also supported clerical fascists from Croatia in helping disintegrate Yugoslavia, which is why they also worked with the so-called Kosovo Liberation Army, which was more or less just the Albanian mafia, the largest smugglers of heroin and other, criminal networks in Europe, that they worked with these forces to disintegrate one of the most multinational, multi-confessional, secular democratic states in Europe at that moment.
You're right. It's that one thing, point we make, not I guess in this book, but an article on the dismantling of Yugoslavia. We point out that Serbia was the only part of Yugoslavia where there was no ethnic cleansing whatsoever during the Yugoslav wars. And Muslims could come into Serbia from the other town and they would be tolerated. The Roma, the Gypsies came in. The Croatians came in. Nobody was thrown out. Nobody was persecuted in Serbia. Now, the Bosnian Serbs engaged in ethnic cleansing. But that was part of a land-grabbing system that was precipitated by the U.S. refusal and the U.S. and Izetbegovic's refusal to negotiate a peaceful settlement. Mm-hmm. They thought they could win by arms so they forced a war, and everybody therefore sought land, and there was ethnic cleansing. So it wasn't Serbs. It was really Izetbegovic and the U.S.'s policies toward that area.
So, Edward, by way of conclusion, I was wondering if you'd be interested in offering some broader reflections on the state of the world today, contextualizing the politics of genocide, which is discourse analysis. It's a media analysis of how things appear, but behind appearances are essences. Would you care to offer some reflections on how things are unfolding in the world right now?
Well, as you can tell from what I've been saying in the book, The Politics of Genocide, I'm pretty pessimistic about the scene right now because we really have a kind of global class war at work. It's a global class war, the war on terror, the expansion of NATO. I mean, is NATO growing rapidly after the death of the Soviet Union, which really has no justification except that it's an instrument of Western expansionism and Western attempt to control. And it's militarizing everybody. Sweden, Norway, Finland, all the Eastern European countries, they're all being militarized, and little mercenary armies are being cultivated there, and they're all being told that there's a big threat. Where's the threat? Islamofascism? Maybe it's Russia, but Russia, which is a very, which is really being steadily provoked. We're expanding all around the Russian borders. We're building these missile control systems that really essentially threaten Russia. Just imagine how the United States or Canada would feel if Russia put missile defenses in Mexico and Cuba. Yeah. But we're doing this all around Russia.
Yeah. And China, right?
And China, and supporting a little engaging in democracy promotion all around the edge of Russia. We're being incredibly provocative.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I've been thinking about recently, too, is that this is a global class war, but it applies, I'm pretty sure, to Canada, but I know it applies to the United States. In books that I've written in the past, I point out the fact that what the United States transnationals want and that dictate foreign policy, they want a favorable climate of investment.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we would support Marcos in the Philippines and Suharto and the military dictatorship in Brazil and the military occupation of
Haiti.
Yes, but they think that's striking me forcibly now, is that we're bringing this home. It's blown back. The United States, the elite in the United States, the inequality is so great. The elite has such power over politics that they're actually carrying out a war against the mass of American people. Both the Republicans and Democrats are really under the control of money, but the Republicans are blatant and brazen about it.
Mm-hmm.
And ordinary American citizens that are under siege. This is the richest country in the world, but we're pouring $1 trillion a year probably into arms and wars, and our infrastructure is falling apart. We won't do anything for the rising homelessness. It's really pretty unbelievable. The class war has intensified. The business community is trying to create a still more favorable environment of investment in the United States, and I'll bet it's happening in Cuba.
Yeah.
So we're in a really kind of sick period where ordinary citizens are under siege.
Mm. So just to sum up, we only have a few seconds left on the show, so that our listeners can take some of your information, your analysis, go away, do their own research. Just to sum up, what are some of those conflicts in the world today? Name a few that we absolutely know so little about that are being denied and covered up, and which are some of those that are being entirely distorted, inflated, and work to the interests of imperialism, the two categories, if we can break it down like so.
Well, there's these conflicts at home. We have the class war at home. We have NATO expanding everywhere.
Yeah.
We have an escalating war in Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard to pinpoint. We're attacking in Somalia. It's amazing to see Barack Obama, the man of supposedly going to bring change, actually in some ways escalating Bush's policies.
Mm-hmm.
It's really it's pretty sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I gather things aren't much better up in Canada either.
You've got a
president that almost makes Obama look good.
Yeah, we have one of the most staunch supporters of Israel in the world.
Yeah.
We have a staunch defender of the most criminal human rights abusing regimes in the world, for example, Philippines, Sri Lanka, Colombia, Israel, all the nasty players, Rwanda. That's what we're dealing with up here too, Edward.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Good to be with you, Steve. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was Edward S. Herman that we were speaking with, the author of the recent title, The Politics of Genocide, which came out this year from Monthly Review Press. I am Steve DeSilva, and I'm here with...
Kirti.
And we're signing off with Radio Basics tonight, Friday, December...
The 10th?
The 10th. All right.
Yes.
Radio Basics, we're out. Good night.
Good night.